morning, Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor.
All right, both counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Please do so.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My client, Mr. Pratt, went into court on Kauai that day with a clearly established fundamental constitutional right, plainly defined by the Hawaii Supreme Court. We assert that the court below essentially eviscerated that right, making its practical application so vague and elusive as to render it almost meaningless by subordinating it to any regulation without any written inquiry at all whether the regulation was narrowly tailored such as to protect that right.
Mr. Hempe, just to put this case in context, I want to confirm that for Mr. Pratt, what he wants out of this is to confirm that his activities, as set forth in the district court's findings of fact, fall within that constitutional protection under the Hanabi test. Is that correct?
Well, that's part of it. I mean, not to oversimplify it, I think the most important thing that he wants is to not be convicted of three misdemeanors.
Okay.
Okay.
Because there was some discussion with the district court at the sentencing that about this being a test case, and I thought there was some reference in your request for retention of oral argument that Mr. Pratt wants to know also, in addition to not being, you know, convicted, he wants to know if he has a right to do what he did.
Right, under current law. And let me say that's true.
Okay,
and I just
want to be really clear.
Well, I think both parties agree here that really in terms of the evidence and proof that was submitted at trial with regard to the exercise of Mr. Pratt's, you know, traditional customary Hawaiian rights, that the law does potentially need clarification.
Okay. Well, and I apologize for interrupting your argument, but it'd be helpful if we could talk about this too. I know it's a little, it's easier to get up there and say stuff, but I bear with me. I do have some other questions on that. Now, my understanding from reading the Hanabi case and the other cases is it's pretty clear that the assertion of a constitutionally protected right is, quote, a purely legal issue. There's factual findings, but the determination itself of whether what was happening here, that determination is a legal conclusion. Do you agree with that?
Yes, and may I expand on that a little bit?
Yeah.
Your Honor, the court in Hanabi talked about what is needed, what is required to actually prove that legal right. And it's a three-part test. And as the court obviously knows, the activity must have taken place on undeveloped land. The person who did it must be a descendant of the Hawaiians from prior to 1798, I believe. And most importantly, the court in Hanabi said, we need to prove that the right was a traditional and customary right entitled to constitutional protection. So this trial court already found that we proved those three things. We proved, and it's in the findings, undeveloped land, Native Hawaiian, and that it was a traditional and customary right. Our expert clearly testified that it was protected by law, that was uncontroverted testimony.
Right.
So the
right
is protected.
But a finding is a fact. A conclusion is a legal conclusion. And so I think in order for us to reverse the convictions, we would have to agree to the totality of his claim that this was constitutionally privileged, right?
Well, right. And I think, you know, he made a legal conclusion. Obviously, we're on a de novo standard as to legal conclusions, but he based his legal conclusion on three findings of fact, that it was undeveloped land, that he was a native Hawaiian, and that it was a traditional and customary practice. So given that...
So is your position that once those three findings are made, that the legal conclusion necessarily follows?
It's my position that that's what Hanapi says. That is the law of the state.
But
it's
does it
also?
Yeah, but Hanapi says that those are factors that must be satisfied at a minimum, right?
Yes. And again, the court found that we satisfied those factors. The court had no problem in finding that Mr. Pratt, you know, was authentically and legitimately exercising a
right,
protected activity. What the court did is it disagreed with me, and I'd like to read this at some point. What the court did is it disagreed with me that that was it. The court said, no, Mr. Hempe, there's also a balancing test in there somewhere based on other cases that led to Hanapi, and I find, the court said, the court finds that on balance, even though your client has constitutionally protected rights, even though your client is engaging in a traditional and customary practice, I find that the balance of protecting society's right to regulate the park outweighs that.
Right, but wasn't the district court really repeating what's in Hanapi and Pash, which is that constitutionally protected Native Hawaiian rights must be reasonably exercised?
Yes, he was trying to get to that point, and one of the points, I have a list of three particular errors that we find, you know, problematic, and one of them is that Hanapi, while it puts the burden of proof on the defendant to prove those three initial elements
at a minimum,
Hanapi is absolutely silent as to who has the burden of proving reasonableness or unreasonableness. And that, I want to say that very clearly, when you can't tell who has the burden of proof as to reasonableness or unreasonableness under the law, that to me by definition is ambiguous. And of course, ambiguities are to be strictly construed in favor of the accused. And I want to say this, even if there is a balancing test, and the court ruled really in terms of a balancing test, I noticed the opposition brief talks a lot about the reasonableness aspect, and it's a little bit, you know, confabulated between the two, but even if there is a balancing test where we should balance the weight of my client's fundamental constitutional right to practice his culture. And I just want to say...
Okay, wait, let's talk about his fundamental constitutional right. But isn't he asserting that part of his constitutional right is to reside at least temporarily in the park without a permit?
Well, yes, Your Honor. And our expert testified that temporary residence for an extended period of time
you need to stay by the mic, because the mic is the...
So bring
your... tablet, but the mic is a recording device.
Our expert testified without any contradiction from the other side in this case that based on her education and expertise and interviews with the defendant, my opinion is that Mr. Pratt is engaging in a traditional and customary practice related to substance, cultural, and religious purposes. And she went on to say that temporary residences for an extended period of time is a traditional and customary practice.
Did she tie that in any way to Kalalau Valley? Did she say that it was a traditional practice in Kalalau?
Absolutely. And that she talked about where his lineage came from. She talked about the Huna tradition in which he was trained. This whole case was about Kalalau.
I thought her testimony was that she didn't have any expertise in Huna.
I think that was true, but she was able to validate that Mr. Pratt did.
What's the significance of those ties to Kalalau? In other words, what if we had a Native Hawaiian who had never been to Kauai before, born and raised in Oahu, I feel a cultural or traditional need to go to Kalalau to repair the heiau.
That is, you know what, he would lose, and the reason he would lose is because when the courts have determined, you know, how you figure out if something is a traditional and customary right with regard to taking care of land, you have to demonstrate that you've been doing it. Mr. Pratt has been doing it since he was a child.
Okay,
in that valley.
Now I know that that's what Dr. McGregor said, but I don't read that in Kalipi, Pele Defense Fund, Pash or Hanapi. I mean, having done it for 37, what I read in those cases, Mr. Hempe, is that you have to tie it to an ancient customer practice, not 37 years. I mean, don't get me wrong. I understand that he's been going there a long time and doing these things. And
in the tradition of his ancestors who taught him to do it, and his father and his grandfather, I mean, are from
that there's valley. No testimony about his father and grandfather doing this.
I think there was testimony that he was taught this initially. That's how his father started taking him into the valley.
Right, that he went into the valley as a child with his father.
And that's where his ancestors came from, that valley.
Okay. Let's talk about that, because it's clear that he is not a legal resident of Kalalau Valley, correct?
Well, on facially, he violated the regulation. And I want to stop for just 1 second and say, you talked about setting up a residence. He was staying there for several days, cleaning invasive species, taking care of the land, fixing, cleaning the heiau, et cetera, et cetera. He had a tent. If you sleep overnight, you need, by definition, you almost need some residence. We don't have a house with, piping and plumbing and solar systems in here.
Right.
So
no,
I just want to
I guess I'm just repeating what I think is the findings of fact.
Right. I just wanted to clarify that, we're not talking about a stucco,
What is the evidence with respect to the whatever tent or whatever facility he was using for shelter while he stayed in the
camp? My recollection is that it was essentially a tent. A tent and maybe a tarp was involved. And that was just, again, shelter at night. But when, Your Honor, when the court, even if there is a balancing test or a reasonableness factor, and again, I've already submitted that when the burden of proof is unclear, that ought to go our way. I want to strongly point out that even if that exists, I believe the court misapplied it in this case. This is a very important point for us, because we've got my client's rights and all the weight that carries. And the court had to balance that, when the court decided to balance that against the harm. And the court said, the court worried, in balancing it against the harm, on the other side of the harm, the court imposed all the potential worst case scenario future harms that other fictitional hypothetical criminals might do.
So that's your argument, is that you have to balance against actual harm versus hypothetical harm.
Yes, I mean, the court even said...
How do you draw that line? In other words...
Well, it's a criminal case, and I don't think somebody should be criminally penalized for what a hypothetical person might do in the future based on the speculation of a trial judge. I mean, the court even said, Mr. Hempe, I don't agree with you, Mr. Hempe, that the concept should be limited to just one man. If that was the standard, the state can only look at one man, and he's not going to create enough sewage to create a problem, so he's not guilty. The court even said, if we only look at Mr. Pratt's conduct, and it's a criminal case, he's not guilty.
So you think we should just look at the harm, the actual harm that Mr. Pratt caused in doing the balancing test?
Certainly, as respect to Mr. Pratt's case. Now, if the rules get tweaked a little in future cases, that may be another story. But certainly in Mr. Pratt's case, I don't see how we can constitutionally, without running into a tremendous due process and vagueness problem, have criminal convictions based on a trial court's speculation of what...
All right, so say we accept your arguments and we reverse Mr. Pratt's conviction based on privilege. Then 5 years from now, another case comes out, but instead of just Mr. Pratt doing this, or 50 people doing what he's doing. Can we, in that case, rule the other way, that, well, because now it's 50 as opposed to one, the state's interest in regulating has increased, and therefore the balance now weighs in favor of the state?
I think the test under the law right now is whether the actions are traditional and customary practices as practiced back 200 years ago. And if all 50 met that and the court bought it, that they had all proven that, they potentially would have that privilege. Now, if the court, has this balancing test, maybe that's something that could be applied in the future. But again, I think it's fundamentally wrong.
I'm asking you, assuming arguendo, that I know your argument is that there shouldn't be a balancing test, but I'm saying, assuming that we conclude that there is a balancing test, in making that balance, I guess my question is, can circumstances change so that in one case, maybe not harm given the facts of that case, but in a future case, changed circumstances would say, well, maybe the balance does favor the state?
Well, I got to say, I think that's a very dangerous road to go down in a criminal case. You know, I don't know if, I can't think of another criminal situation. I mean, imagine we would be submitting balancing tests to the jury to decide whether somebody's going to be deprived of their liberty or not. I mean, the implications of vagueness to me seem overwhelming. You know, you can go into court and exercising your constitutional right and the jury gets charged with balancing that against society's interest. I don't know that that's enough. Clearly defined enough criminal law to pass constitutional muster in a vagueness sense.
Okay, Mr. Hempe, I found the reference I was thinking of, and this is in the district court's written decision and order entered March 10th, 2006. The district court, and I'll read it to you so you don't have to look it up, but the district court stated its essential findings, which include, quote, the facts show that Mr. Pratt and his wife long ago set up what he calls a residence in the Kalalau Valley. The testimony of Mr. Pratt and photos entered into evidence show the extent of his activity in the valley, which includes clearing large areas. Some of this clearing is at ancient heiau sites, planting food gardens, planting bananas, taros, cocoa palms, constructing an abode, utilizing a garden hose for watering, all of this in a state wilderness area. Now, that those are the activities that were incorporated into the court's findings of fact and right. Are unchallenged.
Right, and I think it's important to note that in Hanapi was convicted specifically because he did not prove those things.
Well, I think wasn't the problem... Well, anyway,
in Hanapi, they said he failed to show that he took care of the land. He failed to show that he cleared the land. That I forget that he took. You know,
I thought that in Hanapi, the problem was that there was no evidence that restoration of the land was an ancient, traditional, and customary practice. And I take that from at page 495 of 7.
Right, and they did. He didn't prove it in Hanapi, but the court did talk extensively in Hanapi what he would have had to prove had he been able to avail himself of that. And one of the and they talked quite a bit about, you know, you got to prove that you go to the land and that you actually do these things. In Hanapi, the guy didn't show, Mr. Hanapi didn't show that he'd ever actually done any those specific things on that land before. He didn't have this, you know, long tradition of caring for it, or he hadn't proven it. But again, we read Hanapi before we went in, and I believe we proved every single thing that they said Mr. Hanapi failed to prove. Your Honors, we don't contest the state's right to regulate activity on public land. However, I just want to stress that under the case law, the state is obligated to protect the reasonable exercise of customarily and traditionally exercised rights to the extent feasible. So I think what we ultimately get into here is what trumps. Does the regulation trump without any constitutional analysis as to whether it was narrowly tailored to protect a compelling government interest, or does the constitutional right trump the regulation? It seems to me that the very nature of a defense of privilege is that it is designed to trump a statute or regulation because it's constitutional. It just comes from a higher authority under the case law. So again, we're not contesting that there's a right to regulate. We're just contesting that in this case, privilege, constitutional privilege, trumps the regulation. This is, and I would say I do a lot of this work, and I've done a lot of things, and this is one of the rare, if only, cases I've been aware of where a defendant has actually come in and proven privilege. And it's very elusive, it seems. You know, it's here in theory and in the case law, but on the ground in the courts, you never see it proven. And I think that really goes against this whole floodgates argument as well. I just don't think that's the experience of any court in the state, that defendants are coming in and proving privilege. In fact, I think it's quite rare, given the the small remnant of Hawaiian culture that's left. I had to say, I can't let today go by without noting the irony of downstairs. There's big pictures about scenes from the overthrow, and I noticed, it just struck me that, you know, there's very little of this culture left, and we have a constitutional right and pronouncements for the Supreme Court saying this is fundamental. It's entitled to constitutional protection. And we've done everything we can, follow the letter of Hanapi almost exactly. And it's just, it seems like this right is almost fictitional. It's so elusive, because then when we went to court, the court says, no, you didn't prove reasonableness, even though Hanapi doesn't say who has to prove reasonableness. I submit that when a defendant proves the three elements, the burden should shift to the state to prove unreasonableness. And then the state said there's a balancing test in a criminal case. And you're up trying to actually apply this right currently seems almost impossible. So I, you're right. I mean, my first goal is to get an acquittal. But in terms of, you know, the law here, I think Native Hawaiians really ought to have a right to know exactly what the test is before they try to do what their ancestors taught them to do, and then justify it in court. So at this point, I think I would defer to the prosecutor if I may reserve the remainder of my time to respond to any points they may make.
That's fine.
Okay.
Tracy Murakami, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney, County of Kauai for the State of Hawaii. The first thing I want to point out is last week I went and pulled out this file again. I think I wrote the brief 4 years ago. And something that I wrote struck me as wrong. And I think Judge Leonard was talking about this. The question of the degree to which this court can review the district court's finding on the reasonableness or the balancing. I believe that factual determination actually isn't a de novo review, as I wrote in my brief. I believe that's an abuse of discretion review, that those are really about balancing facts. And to that extent, this court should defer to the district court's determination, even though it ultimately touches upon a constitutional right. I believe that that factual finding has to be, this court should defer to the district court's finding on that issue.
So you're saying in deciding whether the balance favors the state or the defendant, that's an abuse of discretion test?
I believe so. And there's no case exactly on point. And I looked at a Chapter 92 decision, County of Kauai versus the OIP by the Hawaii Supreme Court in 2009. And that talks about the OIP's balancing of the public's interest in open government versus an individual's constitutionally protected right of privacy. And that finding was reviewed by the appellate court for abuse of discretion. So by analogy, that's the conclusion.
Right, but that case is an agency finding case, right?
It is.
But this case is really a decision on the constitutional privilege issue.
It is.
Which is a question of law.
And that's what I, and that's why I wrote it that way in the brief. But in looking at it again, something didn't seem right to me
this time. In your defense, I guess I would say, and this is what I was questioning Mr. Hempe about, Hanapi says point blank, it's a legal conclusion, it's purely a legal conclusion, whether or not the constitutional privilege.
And I think the problem with Hanapi is Hanapi didn't get as far as we got in this case, because Hanapi said the defendant didn't establish that what he was doing was a traditional
right
practice.
But and that's part of what I was asking Mr. Hempe, is that isn't the satisfaction of the overall test a legal conclusion entered by the district court? I mean, reasonableness is part of the Hanapi test, because it's talking about, at a minimum, there's three factors.
But I think the problem with Hanapi is the court says, at a minimum, there's these three factors. None of those three talk about reasonableness. But yet, when you read Article 12, Section 7, it's got reasonable in the language of the Constitution.
So your analysis is that after you satisfy the three Hanapi factors, you still have to show that your conduct is reasonable, or that there is this balancing of interest that
absolutely
could permit the state to prohibit and otherwise practices that otherwise would be protected by the Constitution.
Absolutely.
All right. And what is that? What case law or what?
There isn't. Like I said, none of the cases have gotten this as far as the defendant got in this case.
So you're basing it purely on the language of the Constitution.
The language of the Constitution, and also PASH. I mean, PASH itself uses, you know, says the state can reasonably regulate. What page am I reading? PASH. It's PASH. Well, I'm reading Alexa's copy. I think it's page 450. So it'd be 79 Hawaii 450. It says the right, you know, a tenant can exercise traditional and customary rights, but that is subject to the regulation in the public interest. Then there's the language of the Constitution. And Hanapi, the state's confident, Hanapi didn't dispose of that right to regulate, because Hanapi itself recognizes that doctrine from PASH. And I'm reading from Hanapi 89 Hawaii at 184. And the Hawaii Supreme Court is saying in Hanapi, this court has consistently recognized that the reasonable exercise of ancient Hawaiian usage is entitled to protection under Article 12, Section 7. And the word reasonable is italicized.
Right, but isn't that exactly where Hanapi says that part of the test is the reasonable exercise of the right?
Correct, but in those first three factors, it's not there. I don't know that reasonableness is somehow in those first three. I don't see it as being there. I think there's a fourth part.
Right, but that, in other words, reasonableness is part of the Hanapi decision.
Yes.
It's just not necessarily incorporated into those factors, unless you put it in the second factor.
Perhaps.
Let me ask you this. Now, it seems like the state's argument, and I'm asking you it, in characterizing it this way, it seems like the state's argument is that all we got to do is show that there's some, that the regulation itself is reasonable, and there's a camping regulation or a restricting closed areas regulation, and on its face it's reasonable because it's a wilderness area and we need protection. But to me, if that's all that's required, then you're not really factoring in the defendant's exercise of constitutional rights. So doesn't it have to be more than simply being able to justify the regulation in the abstract as being reasonable, and don't we have to apply it as being reasonable in the context of the activities alleged in this particular case?
Yes, and I think that's why the state felt compelled to put on evidence about the purpose of the regulation. Why do we limit the number of people in Kalalau Valley at one time? And it's because of a sewage problem. And I think it was Wayne Souza, the DLNR employee, testified that what happens is every summer in Kalalau, people go into Kalalau who don't have permits, and the self-composting toilets fail because it's only they're only set up to handle the number of people that are permitted to go into the valley. So when those numbers start going over the permitted numbers, then we have problems. So the state felt compelled to put on that kind of evidence to show the reason for the regulation. And I think the defendant's biggest problem is the DLNR actually has a venue, this curatorship program, for people like Mr. Pratt who wish to go in for beyond the 5-day permit limitation. You know, they have this other venue to meet with DLNR personnel and develop a plan for what that person's going to be doing. But he didn't even apply for it.
So, is there evidence that that program applies to Kalalau State Park? I know there was some talk generally about DLNR having curatorship-type programs, and I think they talked about it being applied in a different location.
And I think...
But I didn't see anything in the records.
I guess I read it as not having been applied before at Kalalau, but I didn't read it as saying that, you know, it was unavailable at Kalalau.
Counsel, I want to go back to the rights asserted in this case, because there's a lot of activities here. I mean, it's one thing to go and conduct your cultural and religious practices, but it appears that Mr. Pratt is asking for the privilege to apply much more broadly to the right to live for an extended period of time, albeit temporarily in Kalalau, to cultivate the land in a state wilderness area, to modify it for his own use. And so I think, isn't the distinction whether he has a right to go and do these cultural and religious practices versus whether he has a right to go live there and take up residence to do these practices?
Yes, and I think that's why the curatorship program is important, because an applicant like Mr. Pratt would sit down with DLNR personnel and develop a plan. I mean, I don't think that Mr. Pratt can decide what's invasive and what's not invasive, what should be pulled out and what should be planted. I mean, that just doesn't seem right. Without having some kind of official sanction by the DLNR who runs the state park.
So there's nothing in the record to show that the state appointed Mr. Pratt to be a caretaker of the valley, is that correct?
No, in fact, there was evidence that he applied to for some ambassadorship, and it sounded like that was a paid position with the DLNR in
but
the early 90s.
But that was a decade before.
Okay. And he didn't get that.
Right, and Dr. McGregor testified that a caretaker or a ho'oina might be appointed by a halau or community, but there's nothing in the record that he was appointed by anyone, is there?
No. Okay. And I think the record did establish that he did not apply for the curatorship program. So it's hard, in the state's opinion, for Mr. Pratt to argue that he's entitled to defense of this privilege when he hasn't even applied to be in the valley legitimately.
Who testified that there was a curatorship program?
Let me see. I believe that the court was taking judicial notice of testimony in a prior case of Mr. Pratt's. And let's see.
Can the court do that?
It was undisputed. I mean, the defense didn't object. The state, it didn't seem like either party had a problem with that.
But in a criminal case, can you do that?
Take judicial notice?
Of testimony in a prior hearing?
I don't see why not. I guess we do it, I've done it before in a criminal case.
And there was no objection.
And there was no objection. So Wayne Souza, who was the DLNR park superintendent, he testified, again, it's briefly about the curatorship program, but I think the brief nature of it was the function of the fact that the defendant never applied to participate in that program.
We don't know if the program applied to Kalalau State Park. The record is silent on whether, assuming the court can take judicial notice of testimony given at a prior hearing in a different case.
Yes.
The record is silent as to whether there was in existence a curatorship program that would cover Kalalau State Park.
I think Your Honor is correct, yes.
But is a curatorship program necessarily a bar to us finding that Mr. Pratt went too far in this case in setting up residence, clearing land?
I guess the other thing is that the DLNR has a 5-day permit,
right,
that he could have taken advantage of. And he testified that, you know, he needs to be in, it's not practical to go in for the day and out for the night because of how long it takes to get into the valley. There is a legitimate 5-day stay via the permit process. I guess the question is he staying beyond 5 days, can he do that without taking advantage of the curatorship program? The state's position is that if he is going to stay beyond the permitted 5 days and not be permitted, then he's got to be in the curatorship program. Unless there is evidence, and it is not in this case, that he was having no impact on the valley, but where he's planting and pulling things out. I mean, clearly he's having an impact on the valley. And the state also wanted to make a point that something that seems to have been lost a little bit in Hanapi, the trial court in our case found that the defendant was engaged in customary traditional Native Hawaiian practices. When counsel went back and read the transcript, counsel was really sort of stuck on this idea of HUNA. What is HUNA? I've never really heard of HUNA. I've been here my whole life. And so I Googled HUNA. HUNA was created in the 1930s, according to Wikipedia.com, by a guy from the mainland in 1936, to be exact, 1936. Pash talks about an ancient custom as one that was in existence in 1892. And I think that got lost somewhere between Zimring, Pash, it's still there, but in Hanapi it seems to be lost, this 1892 date and its importance. As defining what is ancient.
Right, and so
can we consider your Google evidence as evidence in the case?
Judicial notice, I believe, can be taken
stages
of proceeding.
Let's talk about the testimony in this case, though, because is there any testimony by Dr. McGregor or Pash saying that in the 1800s, for example, that it was the tradition for people who lived outside of Kalalau to travel to Kalalau for extended periods of time and cultivate crops?
I think the defendant testified that the visits to the valley were seasonal.
I think it was Dr. McGregor, and I think what she testified was that it was traditional to travel from the ocean to the mountains seasonally. But I don't recall any testimony that it was the tradition to travel from Waimea to Kalalau.
Correct. And I think that's where at least the trial court here, in applying Hanapi, some of the requirements have gotten a little loose.
Okay. So if even if we don't agree with the conclusions on the balancing of interest between the state and Pratt, we could affirm on any other ground in the record which supports affirmance. That's black letter law, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But the state conceded that the defendant, based upon Dr. McGregor's testimony, had satisfied the Hanapi factors, correct?
Yes, Your Honor is correct. And I think...
Isn't the trial judge and isn't the defendant entitled to rely upon that concession?
Yes, and the state feels like it's stopped at this point from asking the court to, you know, find that he wasn't engaged. But if the court's going to especially issue a published decision in this case, I feel like some of the requirements from Pash have got lost in Hanapi, and just wanted to apprise the court of the state's position on that
issue. But you do agree that Hanapi says that the assertion of a constitutionally protected right is a purely legal issue that must be determined by the court. That's what Hanapi says.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Let's see. That's actually all that the state has. I guess the state's main concern is that this court not conclude that Hanapi got rid of the state's right to regulate, or got rid of the requirement that the defendant's exercise of his right be carried out in a reasonable manner. And the state believes it's unreasonable for the defendant to be in the valley without a permit, without even trying to take advantage of the curatorship program, which would allow him to be there, assuming he and the DLNR could agree on what it is he's going to be doing there and for how long he would be there for any given stay. Thank you.
Thank you again, Your Honor. I'd like to take my last 5 or 6 minutes to clear up a couple of things and respond to a couple of things. First of all, I just want to make a note. The court said something about modifying the land for his own use. And I just want to make the point that my understanding of the traditional and customary Hawaiian practice was really not to modify the land for your own use, but it's to protect and care for the land to make it better. It's not a selfish act. And Mr. Pratt testified that he watched his entire life and never once saw the DLNR clean the heiau, never once saw the DLNR remove the invasive species. He went there to take care of the land.
So how did he
get the land?
Who appointed him the caretaker?
Well, I think that goes back again to, you know, the tradition, the Native Hawaiian tradition and his family. And that actually dovetails nicely into where I was going to go next. The court had asked me earlier about his family and how he got to be in this position, and I found it. It's at page 75 in the transcript. I was questioning Dr. McGregor, and I said the third element of it is there's a tradition. According to her test, is there's a traditional connection by family or training to the place. And I asked her, how do you conclude that that element's been satisfied? And Dr. McGregor said, well, Mr. Pratt was descended from ancestors who lived in the valley by the name of Kupahea. They resided in the valley for an extended period of time.
Is there any findings that he is descended from Kupahea that owned property in the valley?
I don't know if the court made a specific finding, but the court clearly found that he was, a Native Hawaiian descended from
Native Hawaiian, but they didn't find that.
I think the findings were silent as to that particular point. I don't think he made a finding either way, but I'll also note that there was absolutely no evidence to the contrary at the trial. Zero. And then the other point I want to make, which is also, now we're only on page 76, but I asked Dr. McGregor, I said, let me digress for a minute. You talked about living in the valley for extended periods of time. In your education and expertise, if it is established that he lived in the valley for extended period of time, does that take him out of traditional and customary practices? And the expert said, no. Several areas of our islands, including Kalalau, there's a history of seasonal residence so that Hawaiian families, especially in the summertime, have access to areas that are inaccessible in the wintertime, and they can go in the summertime and fish and salt so they can build up a reserve of food for the winter.
Right, but doesn't it say during the summertime they would go to areas near the shoreline where they could fish and salt the fish?
I don't know if the court has the photos that were in evidence in your record on appeal, but we're very near the shoreline.
Right.
And so then I asked, so traditionally and culturally, Hawaiians didn't have to have a three-day limit in their stays in the valley because of some regulation? And she said, no, the regulations don't come until 1978. So
is there anything in the record specifically on exactly how long Mr. Pratt was staying when he was engaged in his activities in the park?
I can't pull that off the top of my head, but I believe it was about 2 weeks at a time he would go in, and that's and care for the value.
Yeah, I'm not asking you your personal knowledge. I'm asking you, is there anything in the record that would say what the period of time that we're talking about?
It's in there. I can't remember off the top of my head. I want to say it was about 2 weeks, but I'd have to.
It would have been Mr. Pratt's testimony, or would somebody?
Yeah, Mr. Hempe, didn't you skip over the part where she testified that at other times they would live inland during the rainy winter months? So it sounded like what she was saying was that parts of the year they would be near the ocean and the rest of the year they would be.
Yeah, I think she was saying that sometimes in the summer they would go into these valleys that they couldn't access and they would be in there for extended periods of time. And then sometimes in the winter they'd go deeper in where it was more protected. And then, based on her analysis of all these conclusions and her interviews with Mr. Pratt and research, she concluded that, again, what he did there was traditional and customary. And finally, Your Honors, two other things, actually. First of all, I object to the concept of the curatorship. It wasn't in evidence. I believe the judge actually brought it up at sentencing and started telling Mr. Pratt, well, I remember from a previous case that there was some kind of a curatorship program. It is, as the court noted, it's not set. There's nothing in the record about it. We don't even know if the curatorship program would have allowed these practices, if it is available in Kalalau and if he had applied. And finally, Your Honors, I don't want to leave this completely unaddressed, but the court also found that Mr. Pratt was engaging in religious practices. And there's a lot of talk about that, what he did, and the prayers and the cleansing ceremonies and whatnot. And we did raise the issue of federal law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And, of course, I think the court probably knows that's the statute that reversed the Oregon versus Smith, the peyote case. And under that act, if a statute or a regulation unreasonably burdens religion, again, there is a burden on the state to prove that the government has a compelling interest, and what's missing here, that the statute or regulation is narrowly tailored to protect that interest. The court simply sort of brushed that off and said, I find that the defendant, I think the court said, we find that the defendant didn't show that his conduct falls within that. And so I don't know what to make of that, because on one hand the court said it was a valid exercise of religion. Clearly the statute, the regulation at issue is burdening that, and yet, you know, we have a no response whatsoever from the state or the court as to whether that was narrowly tailored to protect Mr. Pratt's constitutional rights. And so I think I'm going to conclude at this point, and again with this, with going back to sort of my original 3 points, we submit that there is no balance. We submit that there cannot really be a balancing test that in a criminal case like this. We submit it's just almost absurd to have a jury balancing interests to decide a conviction. We acknowledge that the cases do talk about reasonableness, although they are silent as to the burden of proof. Therefore, lenity should result in an acquittal. We believe that based on all the findings of fact and the uncontradicted testimony of our expert and the defendant, that the conduct was inherently reasonable anyway. And finally, we contend that if the state, if the court did properly engage in this balancing test, that it did it wrong by including in the balance, again, the future harms of hypothetical people who may do the same thing in the future, as opposed to the actual harm done in this case. Because in fact, I think the testimony was very clear that in this case, there was zero harm done and a lot of good done for that valley. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take the case under submission.